This is Vermont Edition. I'm Jane Lindholm. Now that the weather is finally getting warmer, lots of Vermonters are dusting the cobwebs off their bicycles and clipping their feet into the pedals for some hardcore cycling. But a lot of other people just want to get themselves to the general store and back, or off to the beach, or to work. And yes, we know, some of you even bike commute all year round. Bikes are a great mode of transportation, and some local organizations want to encourage more people to think of their bikes before their cars when it comes to getting around. Problem is, Vermont is not the friendliest of places, generally speaking, for cyclists. Lots of our roads don't have bike lanes, many don't even have a decent shoulder. And if you're not super confident, you may not want to try that double diamond interchange or attempt to get into a left-hand turn lane in town. So today on the show, we're going to take a look at how some communities are tackling these concerns, and we'll hear from many of you on how you use your bike. People like Deb, who wrote in to say, "I live and work in Burlington, and I ride my bike back and forth to work every day of the year, despite the weather. If I am unable to ride, which has been approximately 5 times in the past 12 years, I will ski to work." Deb says, "My attitude is such that riding is never not an option." So we're joined today to talk about all of this with our guest, Emily Bodeker. She's the executive director of Local Motion. That's an organization that's working on enhancing a network of roads and trails around the state that bikers and walkers can feel safe and comfortable on. Emily, welcome back to Vermont Edition.
Thanks, Jane. It's lovely to be here on this fabulous biking day.
I know. I'm sad we're in the studio, but such is life. So we should first mention that Local Motion is merging with the Vermont Bicycle and Pedestrian Coalition. And people may know the Bike Ped Coalition. It's an advocacy group that really works to try to get more awareness of cycling and works in the legislature and works around the state to try to get people to do more that would help cyclists and walkers. And Local Motion has worked to create these trail networks around the state to allow people to find ways to recreate. What's this new merged organization's focus?
So really, Local Motion, the Vermont Bike and Pedestrian Coalition, have worked very closely in partnership for a number of years. In fact, we were even co-located in the same office for the first 2 years. And really, Local Motion started from, as you said, Jane, the recreation side, and the work of Brian Costello and Chapin Spencer to reconnect the Island Line Trail. From that, we went into many different education and training programs, which is kind of where the coalition started. And then the coalition moved to Montpelier to really have more of a legislative focus. And what actually happened just recently is Nancy Schultz, who was the executive director since 2006, under her leadership, the coalition achieved many wonderful things, including 2 key legislative victories, one of which was the passing of the Safe Passage Act in 2010, and then the Drug Driving Act in 2014. And so when she stepped down at the end of 2014, the board of the coalition came to Local Motion and said, "How do we together best serve our walking and biking constituents?"
And so now you're going to be the head of this new organization, and you're sort of doing all of it, the advocacy, the legislative lobbying, and the recreating and trail finding kind of stuff?
Well, you make it sound like a lot. The really good thing is that Local Motion is only one player in the whole suite of bike players within the state of Vermont. I mean, we have more than 60 bike shops who are doing various different things across the state. So Local Motion's role, what we really want to try and do is really threefold. First of all, there are so many local advocates and local leaders who have a real spark and want to see things change in their towns and communities. So the first question is, how do we connect these people with the right tools, the right resources, so that they can really make change happen in their own communities? And there's lots of examples from the recent bike lockers that we helped to put in Winooski and Burlington to other things like our Coles for Kids Bike Smart Training, which is now in 8 counties around the state, that are examples of what people can do. By bringing the two organizations together, there was a lot of overlap already in our programs. It gives us now a more streamlined approach to delivering these programs statewide where we have funding. And it also means that as we're working with local communities, when we find opportunities to remove barriers or accelerate the progress through policy and legislative action, we're one organization that's focused on doing that.
All right, so we're going to dive into this idea of how people can use their bikes for just general getting around. We know a lot of people use their bikes for exercise, and that's fabulous. But what about sort of toddling around town if you want to get to the general store? If you just are trying to get to school or to work or to go to a friend's house, We hear that people are running up against a couple of obstacles, a lack of safe roadside shoulders, for example, and then sometimes a general fear and a lack of confidence. We'd love to hear from you if those are concerns that you have or if you have figured out ways around these roadblocks. Give us a call. Our number is 1-800-639-2211. That's 1-800-639-2211. Or you can post your thoughts on the Vermont Edition page at vpr.net. Tell us how you use your bike. We know cyclists are a really enthusiastic group, so we want to hear from you. Phil wrote in to say, I use cycling as both a mode of transportation to and from work and as a cross-training tool. Normally starting in early April, I will get the bike ready to go. I like to see how long I can go in between filling up the gas tank in my car. Last year, I went 1 month without putting gas in my Subaru, biking almost 500 miles. My daily commute from Bolton to Essex is 15 miles each way. Having to take Route 2 and 117 have not been very enjoyable. Almost being taken out by inattentive drivers and iffy road conditions seem to be the norm. Emily Boedeker, people like Phil, people like Deb, who we've just heard from, are using their bikes to get to and from work. Do you have any sense how many Vermonters use bikes generally?
Here's a couple of examples. So we'll take Burlington. Because it's our biggest city, we have more data there. And one of the few data sets where you can compare from state to state is the commute share. So from 2012 to 2013, Burlington did a massive jump from 5.5 to 6.8% of people who are commuting to work.
Now, trips, on their bikes or just
on their
in
bikes,
general?
Sorry, on their bikes. Thank you for that. 20% actually walk. More than 5% go on public transit. So that's 30% combined who are doing something other than a car, and often a single occupancy car on their road. That's one example. But as we know, how we move around on our roads is for many more reasons than going to work. We go for social outings. You want to go to Little League games. You want to get to the grocery store. So there was another study, People for Bikes, which is a national organization, came out with a study in March 2015. And what they found is that 34% of people rode bikes at least once during the entire year. 24% were riding 6-plus days, and 14% were really riding 100-plus. So if we look at who's riding, now we can all make estimates whether Vermont is above average or below average or on average for national stats like this, but that gives you a sense of what the potential is. And the really key thing to think about is there is an opportunity for every single person, no matter your age, no matter your ability, 8 to 88, to actually make biking part of your daily life. There's 1/3 of the trips that we make are under a mile in length, and 50% are under 3 miles, distances that are eminently walkable and bikeable if we can just get over those little barriers that we put in our way.
But how do you know that people, or that more people, want to do that? How do you know that we haven't just reached saturation and that, you know, anybody who wants to get on a bike is getting on a bike?
Yeah. Part of it is the reason why we decided to bring these organizations together, Jane, because of the demand that we're hearing. So I'll give you a couple of examples there. I'd mentioned early our Coles for Kids Bike Smart training program. We added a second trailer just last year. Already in its first school season, it was 100% booked. It was 60% booked over the summer. And in all, we served 32 schools and camps in 8 different counties. And these 2 trailers, again, just doubled the program, are immediately going to be 100% booked.
So these are bike trailers. You take the bikes to the kids and then take the kids somewhere and everybody goes out and rides?
This actually is a fabulous program because it's train the teacher. So you've got educators who know the kids, who know how to teach. So we teach them how to train the kids on bike skills and road skills. We deliver the trailer to the school. It has all the bikes for the kids. We try and have some adaptive bikes so that anybody can get on a bike. You have all of the stop signs and the cones so you can set up in the parking lot of your school and really teach bike skills, so practical skills. So that's just one example. And I'll use a fun example as well. We put a call out about 2 or 3 weeks ago because May 15th is National Bike to Work Day. We're saying National Bike to Anywhere Day. And we said, hey, in times we've done free bagels to say thank you for riding. So we said, nominate your favorite coffee shop that you want to ride to that day, and we're going to give them a call and see if they will give free coffee, free bagel, whatever that might be. We have had more than 60 nominations. So we are going to do our very best to reach out to all of these coffee shops. This is the Brown Cow in Bennington. This is the Gatto Nero Press Cafe in St. Johnsbury. It's obviously Capel Ground in Montpelier, Maglinero's in Burlington, but all over the place, more than 60 places that people people want to bike to. So we're going to do our
very best. Or they just
best.
Really want free coffee.
Well, you know, you always deserve a reward for biking, whether it means that, you know, you get to enjoy the muffin or the coffee. That's all good. It's all part of the process.
So you haven't reached out to, you haven't gotten all of the coffee shops to say yes to this.
We haven't got them all yet. So if anybody's listening on air and you own a coffee shop and you want to raise your hand before we give you a call, that'd be fabulous.
But Emily, that brings up one of the interesting things about this idea of trying to not reframe exactly, but maybe co-locate cycling for transportation with the idea of cycling for exercise, because I don't think of people, you know, pulling on their spandex, getting on their bikes, cycling, getting really sweaty and thinking, what I really want is a hot cup of coffee. But what you're trying to do here also is say that cycling is something that is a mode of transportation, and you don't necessarily have to get sweaty. You don't necessarily have to wear different clothes. You don't even have to wear different shoes. You do probably or should wear a helmet.
Yes, definitely. We do advocate for a helmet. You've only got one brain. It's beautiful. Let's take care of it. And really, the thing that underlies everything, so whether you are cycling for fitness or recreation or to get somewhere, we're all on the same road and trail network. So anything that we can do to more clearly designate and delineate where you as a biker should be on the road and where the car is, we're going to make things safer for everybody. So if you choose to go 100 miles and get really sweaty, that is your choice. If you choose to wear the flowery summer dress and go to the bakery, again, your choice. And if we can work together to make sure that our roads and our downtowns, our vibrant villages, our vibrant downtowns are welcoming and safe because we clearly designate for everybody where to be on the road, that foundation helps everybody in whatever shape or form you want to bike.
We got a note from Holly in Winooski who talks about the air pollution at this time of year. She says, especially with high, dry winds. Holly wants to know about a face mask product. She says, not eyeglasses. She knows about that, but she's talking about sucking air into her lungs. How can she get around that? And she wants to know if anybody knows of any products like this or if there are reusable face masks that she can buy. We put her whole note up on the Vermont Edition Facebook page. So if you have advice for Holly, please go to the Vermont Edition Facebook page and add your thoughts there. And if you want to comment on the show, you can do it there or you can call 1-800-639-2211. David's on the line with us from Montpelier. Hi, David. Go ahead.
Hi. I'm a longtime biker, and I'm also a member of GMBC. And these guys go out on Sundays, and they're in tip-top shape. But I'm a real advocate for bikers, and I was speaking to her your guest predecessor, I've forgotten her name again, but I was at the Montpelier City Hall. The person that was there from VTPED, and I was asking her about the possibility of a recumbent trike, open source design or something that could be sponsored by the organization that would allow every Vermonter to bike. I think the biggest hurdle is one, the hills, two, people are out of shape. And a recumbent trike design would go a long way. Something that was sponsored that could be easily picked up by local bike shops, that could be put together possibly as a kit by users, as a way to go forward with commuting. Because I think commuting is a great idea, but nobody's going to do it because they're not in shape and because of the hills. That's
do you
fine.
Speak about yourself there, David? Would a trike get you commuting, or
no,
are you already
I'm
doing
a,
it?
I'm in pretty good shape.
So you're already on the bike.
Yeah, I'm already on the bike. I ride with the GMBC guys, and I'm in pretty good shape, and I have an upright road bike. But
good.
I'm just thinking in terms of trying to extend it out to the wider community, something like a recumbent trike design would go a long way towards getting people on the bike and getting them to use it as a, you know, if you want to go to the store to get milk.
Yeah, I hear you, David. Let's put that to Emily. And I think for people who are picturing this, you know, if you've seen those cyclists on the road who are very low to the ground, often there's a big flag sticking up from their recumbent bike so that they can be seen by drivers. And it's sort of like a recumbent bike at the gym. You're sort of leaning back a little bit and pedaling. Emily, do you think that would get more people out on the roads?
You know, the great thing, Jane, is there is a bike for everybody, literally. And so what David has picked up on is a lot of creativity that we're seeing now with bikes themselves. And we'll start with the basics of a bike seat. A bike seat does not have to be uncomfortable. There are so many options and choices today. But in addition to things like recumbents and like trikes, there are two other things which are getting a lot of press these days. One is cargo bikes, and you can either have long tails or long johns where you've actually got the cargo place in front of you or actually behind, and you've probably seen photographs of that where it's almost a bench seat behind and you have two, three kids stacked up there. You've also got e-assist bikes. And so one of the things that we're hoping to do in the near future is to have both a cargo bike and an e-assist bike of some kind at the Trailside Center down on the waterfront on the bike path so that people can come in and see what these bikes are.
And the e-assist bike, is this the kind that helps you motor along?
Yeah, it will actually give you that extra boost when either because you're carrying a load or you're going up a hill. But the really good thing is, and the important thing for people to notice is start where you're at. If you haven't been on your bike for 20 years, get it out of the garage, but go down to one of our really good bike shops. There are bike shops all over the state, from Battenkill in Manchester to Onion River Sports in Montpelier and Brattleboro, St. Johnsbury. So take it to your bike shop, know it's in good working order, and just go out for half an hour, for 20 minutes on a Sunday. So start where you're at.
But if you need to buy a bike, these are not cheap. I mean, even if you want to buy sort of a lower-end bike, you may be looking at a couple hundred bucks.
You can be looking a couple hundred, but the other thing to think about as well is there are a few bike shops around the state that are community bike programs, and I want to mention one of our sister programs in Burlington, which is Bike Recycle Vermont. That was a program of Local Motion until earlier this year, and very exciting, they actually broke off and formed a new organization, which is Old Spokes Home and Bike Recycle Vermont. So we're their biggest fans and cheerleaders, and that's a kind of program where you can walk in, and it's an honor system. They ask you if you're in any of the income-sensitive programs, and then they say, what do you want to do with your bike? They can get you, your family, your kids on a bike, whether it's getting to school, getting to work, or just needing to get outside. So there are definitely a lot of different ways in which people can get to have the equipment they need, but then really start where you're at. Don't think I've got to get on my bike and ride 15 miles. We can all very, very quickly build up a lot more skill and fitness than we realize. And Dave's obviously been doing this for years, but many of us haven't, and there's still a great place for everybody to start.
We got a note from Richard in Chittenden County, who says, I'm a regular bike commuter who also uses the bus. Frankly, it's a great way to start the day. Unfortunately, bike infrastructure is sadly lacking and progress has been glacial. Bike paths end, new lanes are added for cars with no attention paid to other ways of getting around. Most of the key corridors have absolutely no bike infrastructure, and when they do, it ends. We need to set a vision for a place where 8-year-olds mingle with 60-year-olds on key transportation corridors, where clearly delineated bike lanes, bike boulevards without stop signs, bike boxes at intersections, and bike lanes that don't end are the norm. We've got a ways to go. And we have other listeners who want to chime in on that. We're going to move towards this discussion about infrastructure. How do we get to a place where if you want to get on your bike and go to the store, you can do it safely? That's next here as we talk about cycling on Vermont Edition. And if you want to weigh in, you can go to our Facebook page or you can call 1-800-639-2211. I'm Jane Lindholm, and this is Vermont Edition. Today, we're joined by Emily Boedeker, Executive Director of Local Motion. The organization is dedicated to helping people get out and walk or cycle around the state, and it's actually working with V-Trans to try to make sure that our transportation infrastructure is built with more than just cars in mind. Some towns and cities are trying to improve their bike accessibility, too. And we're hearing from some of you today. How do you use your bike beyond exercise? And if you don't, but you'd like to, you can tell us why not. What's going on in your community that makes you feel like this just isn't really an option for you? Call 1-800-639-2211 or post your thoughts on the Vermont Edition Facebook page. Lance is on the line with us from White River Junction. Hey, Lance, go ahead.
Hi. I've been living in the Upper Valley for about 5 years now, and prior to that, I lived in Portland, Oregon for about 15 years, and I've been a bike commuter for well over 13 years now, and moving from Portland, which is a very forward-thinking area, and to Vermont, which I thought was a very forward-thinking area, I'm just taken aback by the lack of infrastructure and bike lanes in my area, the Upper Valley in particular, and really how aggressive car drivers are towards bicyclists on the road, and just the lack of common sense in the bike laws and courtesy and affording a bicyclist, you know, the 3 feet from the edge of the road. I've actually been forced off the road several times, and it's nice to hear that there is progress being made. albeit slow, but progress is being made. And I'd just like to thank everybody involved for that.
Well, Lance, thanks for sharing your perspective and adding that to Richard, who we read from earlier. Emily Boedeker, where do you go from here? Because there's a real frustration from people who are trying to do what you're advocating and saying the infrastructure in Vermont just is not up to speed.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, there's actually a number of things that are pretty exciting right now, Jane. But also one thing that we need to remember, building our roads takes time. So we need to get engaged in any road design, any planning process right now, and be making sure that within those plans, we're advocating for what we want to see built in the next 5, 7, 10 years.
So what do I do? Just roll down the window when I see my local road crew and say, hey, you're building a bike lane?
You can certainly start there, but what I would advocate first is getting involved at your town level. Start the conversation with your friends and neighbors, what do you want? Then have a look at what is, opportunities in your town to be on the Planning Commission, on the Trails Commission, on the Parks Commission, to start a Safe Streets Committee so that you get to have a voice in what you want. So what we're talking about here is getting involved in the planning for the long term, but there's absolutely things that we can do in the short term. We've got a great crew at VTrans right now, and one of the things that they're trying to do is to clarify guidance at this point in time for both paving and leveling projects about lane width. Now, thinking about this, you'd think, isn't this a lane width standard? Part of it depends where you start measuring from. Although replacing a road base and expanding a road base is going to take a lot of money and a long time, where we have a base of a road that, say, is 24 foot wide, if we actually stripe in the middle of that road base and measure a lane 11 foot, what we effectively get is a shoulder on either side. So rather than striping a foot in from the outside, if we take that 11 foot lane and stripe from the middle, it won't be in all places, but we can in fairly swift order get a shoulder and at least have a place that's delineated from the vehicular traffic for a bicyclist to go. But one more point that Lance made as well is there are a lot of laws. And, we've actually had a look at this at a couple of junctions in Burlington, because there's definitely drivers say, bicyclists don't obey the law, and bicyclists say drivers don't. And honestly, it's kind of on both sides. But we had a look at a couple of junctions and see how many people on a bike or a car ran a stop sign or pushed the yellow or whatever it is. We're trying to kind of like go back to the source and see where we can have a greater influence. And one of the things we're doing right now is working with the Vermont Police Academy. And we're developing a new curriculum with them to train about bike and pedestrian issues. So what is the law? What can be enforced? What are some other options about how to get people to kind of like, play better together on the road? So be involved today, plan for the long term, but also, today there are things that we can do by treating each other with more respect and obeying those laws and encouraging our local town crews, our local transportation district office of VTrans to really make these changes which can occur today.
Let's go back to the calls. A lot of listeners want to weigh in. Tim's on the line from Hampton, New York. Hi, Tim. Go ahead.
Oh, hi. Yeah, I'm a bike shop owner, but also a year-round commuter cyclist. A lot of things I'd love to say, but to keep it short, I would encourage people to look at the League of American Cyclists website, and they are great with bicycle education. So we don't have a lot of infrastructure, but they're great for teaching you how to use your bike basically as a slow-moving vehicle with a lot of techniques and tips to keep you safe as a cyclist on the road. Our family rides year-round, and we live about a mile from town. It's not too steep, but we will go through a bit of snow and stuff, and just encourage people to do it. I think it's a realistic alternative or an additional thing to your car for those shorter trips.
Tim, thanks for your call. Appreciate that. Let's talk now with Dave Cohen. He's the founder of V-Bike, which promotes electric assist technology and cargo bikes. Dave's calling in from Brattleboro. Go right ahead.
Hey, it's great to be on, and really great that Emily's on this program. Yeah, so V-Bike is a relatively new nonprofit organization I think Emily might be familiar with, and, mm-hmm. And our main focus is to promote really exciting innovations and solutions, including electric assist technology and cargo bikes, which incidentally profoundly expand the range, the carrying capacity, hill climbing ease, and overall utility of biking. And the important point is here that it makes bikes way more relevant for Vermonters. I mean, we live in hilly places. I have an electric assist cargo bike, and Just used it this morning with my son. He goes to a school way up in the hills, and he actually rode his own bike, but he could also hook his bike onto my bike, and I can carry him up. And we actually ride year-round as well. And the other thing is, so V-Bike actually has a contract with Go Vermont, which is our state alternative transportation agency, to provide consultations to Vermonters. To help them choose the right kind of cargo bike, e-assist bike, or electric assist option to add on to the bike or cargo bike, to really just change and redefine the whole nature of biking in Vermont.
Dave, that's very cool. Thank you for calling in. Appreciate it. Nice to hear about how you get your son to school in the morning. Let's get one more person weighing in here. Martina's calling in from Norwich. Martina, go right ahead. Hi.
Yes, thank you. I'm from the Netherlands, and I've been riding a bike, I guess, since I was 3 years old. Now, in the Netherlands, kids in school already teach, are taught the rules of the road on how to ride a bike. They even have a traffic exam for kids. But the one thing that is really lacking here in the United States, though, is that drivers are not told when they have driver education, and there is never a word said about bicycles and how to treat bike people on a bike.
Yeah, Martina, thanks for that. I appreciate your call. And let's talk about that a little bit with Emily Boedeker here, who she's executive director of Local Motion. And we're talking about biking today. We're talking about all the different ways that you can use your bike and some of the impediments people find. Martina's saying drivers aren't really taught about cyclists. And, you know, I think it's also true that probably cyclists aren't taught as much here as they are in some other countries. You kind of learn from your parents or you learn when you're growing up and then that's it. And you're sort of expected to know the rules of the road. And a lot of people who might want to go out on their bike and go to the general store, I mean, there's a little bit of trepidation, both because you're worried about drivers, but also perhaps your own skills, not in staying upright, but in maneuvering among cars and all the other ways that you've got to get from one place to another.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, a lot of things in what you just said there, Jane. Yes, we can always do more education. That's a lot of what Local Motion and the Coalition have done before. So I'd say if you're interested, then contact us and see if we can get the Bike Smart Kids Skills to your school. Contact us if in your town or your place of work you'd like our everyday bicycling workshop. That's actually something now where we've reached out and we have trainers throughout the state, everywhere from Northfield to Johnson to Bennington to Rutland, all over the place where we can deliver these trainings. So that's the first thing. Know your own skills. Feel confident in that. We also want to continue to do more work with both the police academy and also other education so that we can have more than just an occasional multiple choice question in your driving test on biking. So that's definitely a point there from Martina. And you know, the Netherlands is wonderful. It's lovely to see what has happened to that country. And I remember seeing a couple of photographs about getting our children engaged. And that was actually the kind of seat, Jane, that's up on the handlebars of the bicycle itself. And young kids are strapped in there. They're very safe. And they are essentially learning kinetically how to ride a bike, how to balance, and mum's actually navigating them safely through traffic and on the bike lanes. So there's a lot we can do to make sure that this is part of our upbringing and our education, and making sure that activity and active lifestyles are something our kids embrace from their earliest years.
Emily, you mentioned that there are some communities that are really thinking about this. So beyond just working with VTrans on big road projects and corridors, can you give me an example of a town that's thinking about all the different uses for bikes and for cycling and how they're actually making that part of the town plan?
There's a wonderful example from Essex and Essex Junction, who completed their walk bike master plan last year. And actually, Essex Junction is now applying for bike-friendly town status. So that's a great thing. Beautiful thing they did in their plan is they said, okay, we have different kinds of cyclists. So they developed a plan for where they want to have a network of connected bike infrastructure, lanes, paths, all that kind of thing, for the experienced cyclist and also for the novice cyclist. So if you want to be able to ride through town and do 30, 50, 100-mile loops, there's a different kind of facility you need on the street. if you actually want to be able to bike from your neighborhood to the grocery store, and within the town plan, they said we want our kids to be able to bike to school, then you need to be looking at more separation between the paths. You need to be looking at some kind of vertical delineation between where the bikes are and where the cars are. And that gives so many more people such a great leap in confidence. And some of the numbers that you see about the growth in biking and the growth in use of a bike lane, if you even just put a flimsy plastic flex post, are incredible, the growth rates that you see.
So to put a fine point on this, one of the things that you're doing is talking about the economic benefit to Vermont if we improve our bike accessibility. Because as we heard from one of our callers earlier, who's comparing us to Portland, Oregon, and saying that we are not up to snuff, how do you think this would benefit Vermont? I mean, you just mentioned bike-friendly town status, which sounds like an appeal to new residents and tourists.
Mm-hmm. There are so many different ways. There was a study that Local Motion was part of. It was 2012, and it looked at a snapshot of 2009. And this estimated that for walking and biking, the benefit to Vermont was $83 million. Then it said, if you could also add on top of that the health benefits for each of us individually, and even things like an increase in property value because you have a walkable, livable downtown, because you're next to bike facilities and bike paths, that could be as much as $400 million. And so imagine, Jane, what if biking was important to the Vermont economy in the summer as skiing is in the winter? And actually, the summer for a bike, I have been out on my bike for a month. I am not year-round, I have to confess. I've been out on my bike for a month, and I'll be out on my bike until November. So we can really have an 8, 9, 10-month season here. And there are so many ways from bike touring, let alone our individual benefit, less carbon, greater health benefits, that could really be a boost for Vermont.
All right, quick question from Maddie in Burlington before we go. Maddie says, I'm 51, low income and disabled, used to bike a lot, miss it. Most of my trips are medical appointments, errands, visits to friends, seldom more than a few miles from home. But Maddie wants to know if there's any assistance in both choosing and subsidizing a bike for someone like me. We've talked a little bit about how to get help from bike shops and choosing, but what about subsidizing the price? Any programs like that around?
Maddie, the place you need to go is Bike Recycle Vermont, our sister organization that's up there on Riverside Ave in the old North End. They can get you on a bike. Fabulous people there. Ask for Dan or Christine, a whole host of volunteers, and they can both help you get a bike that's affordable and that's right for you.
All right, that's Emily Boedeker. She's Executive Director of Local Motion. Thank you so much for being on the show.
Thank you, Jane. It's been a pleasure.
I'll wrap up with a note from Liam, who says, this is a great discussion, but if we're talking about bike commuting, this needs to be a conversation about people on bikes instead of saying cyclists. Using terms like driver, cyclist, or pedestrian when talking about shared streets reduces people to the vehicle they choose. We are all people first and vehicles second, which is important for everybody to remember while on the roads here in Vermont. Thanks for the tip, Liam. And if you want to share your thoughts on biking, go to the Vermont Edition Facebook page. Coming up, Burlington's got a problem. It doesn't have enough affordable housing. Last night, the City Council had a first crack at debating a plan to solve that problem. We'll get the details next on Vermont Edition. Welcome back to Vermont Edition. I'm Jane Lindholm. Last night, the Burlington City Council began discussion of a massive plan to address housing in Vermont's largest city. Issues include figuring out how to house Burlington's homeless population, dealing with the large number of local college students who flood the market, and addressing the aging housing stock and lack of affordable rental properties for families and non-students. Here to tell us what's in the plan and how it was received is 7 Days reporter Alicia Fries. Nice to talk with you again.
Thanks for having me.
So this is a 17-point housing plan.
It's up to 18 now.
Oh my gosh. Okay, 18-point housing plan now. And the City Council is going to allow some community input before it votes on the plan officially next month. Let's talk a little bit about some of the highlights. We won't get to all 18 points, but we can talk about them. One of the things that people often complain about is trying to find housing in Burlington because so much is gobbled up by students that are at the local colleges and want to live off campus. So what's in the plan to ease the pressure from the influx of students looking for housing?
Right. So they have the Mayor Weinberger administration has estimated the problem, if you want to call it that. They say there's approximately 3,000 students living in the Burlington downtown and neighborhood areas. So they want to add 1,500 units to try to draw those students out of some of the historic neighborhoods. And they want to do that both on campus and in They are calling it a purpose-built housing downtown. Other people would call it essentially a dorm downtown.
So this would be in collaboration with the colleges?
Yes, yeah.
And university?
Yeah. And that was a source of some controversy last night. You hear a lot of people say that the colleges, this is primarily UVM and Champlain College, that they should be taking more responsibility in really housing all of their students on campus. So we did hear objections to the concept of a dorm in the downtown.
All right. So one of the other points, another population that's addressed in this plan is the homeless population. And how does Mayor Weinberger and the city council think about addressing the issue of homeless people who are living in Burlington?
One clear proposal that they identify in the plan is to create a low barrier warming shelter. So this is a place during the cold weather where people who have been drinking or using drugs could come in. They wouldn't be able to use drugs on the premises. So that's one clear proposal. They're also putting support behind the concept of the housing first model, where you prioritize the most vulnerable homeless people and get them into housing, although it's not clear what the city role would be in that.
All right, so not just low-income or no-income people in Vermont, and not just students. The plan is also designed to accommodate moderate-income families, senior citizens, other people who feel a little bit priced out of the market because of what we talked about earlier, all the students, but also this sort of high price in rent if you're a non-student. So what's in the plan for that?
Yeah, I mean, this is a significant piece of the mayor's approach, and it kind of distinguishes him from previous administrations. And he's saying, we've done a great job of creating a lot of affordable housing for people who qualify for subsidies. He's saying we have not done enough for people who don't qualify, who are still lower income, but not to that extent. So they're talking about spurring development by reducing some of the barriers that developers have identified. So a couple of proposals they have on the table. One would be to eliminate the developers are required to provide a certain amount of parking when they do a project downtown. So one of the proposals is to eliminate that because that's a costly item for them. Another proposal is just to reduce the fees when they're putting in an application for a project. And then another proposal, which is somewhat convoluted, is it would basically amount to a total redo of the city's zoning code. It's called form-based code. And the basic concept is that you are approving projects on the basis of these set requirements relating to their physical features, and you don't have this development review board making decisions about whether something feels too big. So that's another major proposal that's part of this plan.
Well, those things that you just mentioned, the easing parking restrictions, lowering the fees, talking about different multi-use or different purpose building, are those likely to be contentious? Because I can imagine parts of Burlington where people might say, hang on a minute, we don't even necessarily want more development.
Yeah, I think some of them will be quite contentious. The parking proposal has already come up and met with a lot of resistance. And the form-based code, I think people have told me this, that they don't really understand it well enough to offer specific criticisms. But I think there's a lot of anxiety around it because people don't understand it, and it is a major overhaul.
And you say that in the south end of Burlington, that's one area where residents are a little bit worried about what might be happening in this plan. For people who don't live around Burlington, can you just describe what the south end is like and why people might be concerned?
Sure. So the south end has really blossomed and over the course of the last decade or so. And there are a lot of artist studios and startup businesses, and then you've got some bigger businesses like Dealer.com, and then still some industrial spaces. And so this has been identified, and it's identified in the plan as a place that would be really good for housing. They say there are a lot of parking lots and just unused space. But there is real concern that the people who are currently living and working there will either get priced out, or if you add housing, then it's going to be incompatible with the businesses that are currently there.
What else do you see in the plan, Alicia, that you found interesting or potentially problematic?
I think the one area that we haven't touched on yet that will definitely spur some interesting debate is the inclusionary housing ordinance, which is this ordinance that's been around for about 25 years in Burlington, and it requires developers to set aside a certain number of units in a new project for lower income people. And there is a consensus that that ordinance needs to be looked at again. And there will be calls to roll it back. And I think there will be real resistance to that. Again, that's an issue of developers saying it just makes it too costly for us to build in Burlington.
Bottom line, do you think there will be a solid housing plan that will come out of the city council? Is there any chance that this will just get sort of buried and moved on to the next year or two?
I don't think so. The administration has devoted an immense amount of time to this. And they've also, they brought in city councilors early in the process. So I think they've been building collaboration for a while. And I think the council will get behind a plan. There might be some small changes. But I think where we will see real debate is when those plans actually get hashed out.
So what is the next step for people who either want to weigh in or just want to know what the timeline is?
Well, the council was originally planning to vote on the plan on April 27th. They got some feedback last night, people asking them to slow down. So it's a little bit up in the air when the next, turning point will be.
But there's a community meeting in May, early May, that people can talk at.
Yes, I don't know the details. But yes.
All right, we'll put the details up at vpr.net. We'll get some info on that. Alicia Fries is a staff reporter for 7 Days, and she's been telling us about the work the city of Burlington is doing to improve its housing market. Alicia, thanks for talking with us.
Thanks so much.
And it's time now for a few of your comments on the show. Producer Rick Sangari is here to help. Hi, Rico.
Hey there, Jane. With fraternities in the news for a host of reasons, we took a look last week at Greek life on campuses in our region. Scott and Winooski objected that our guests were primarily academics or student life staff.
He writes, it would have served the conversation much better to have members of the current Greek life system participate in the conversation. Better yet, reach out to some of the national fraternal organizations that represent both fraternities and sororities to provide a more realistic and nuanced view of Greek life today, rather than Greek life 30 years ago. I just think you guys missed the mark on this one.
Another topic we took up last week was the intersection of economics and conservation. Our guests made the argument that people who care about effective stewardship of the natural world need to understand the fundamentals of economic theory. Paul responded to that discussion with this comment. The core problem to me is that bobolinks and other endangered species do not have much money to spend on their habitat. Furthermore, the success of capitalism relies on a growing economy. As the economy grows, it eats up all the resources around it. How can a bobolink compete?
And on the same note, Jordan wrote, today in economics, we can place a dollar value on just about anything. If there was an economic value system on having a wilderness experience, then we would have a social economic indicator to what wilderness preservation was worth to those who experience it.
And finally, yesterday's Spring Bird Show was as popular as ever. We crowdsourced a lot of listener questions, but bird diva Bridget Butler has answers to a couple that we didn't get to.
Alec wrote, this late winter, there have been many barred owls hunting around bird feeders. One night I found one inside our barn sitting next to our horse, I assume hunting for mice. There's been talk that they are starving. So do you think it's a good idea to try to feed them with, say, trapped mice or just leave them alone?
And here's what Bridget had to say.
Best to leave them be. It's part of the natural cycle. In a way, when we choose to have feeders, we're not just feeding small birds, but raptors as well. You might consider leaving brush piles in the winter in strategic spots, as mice, voles, and rabbits will take shelter there, and might become a great meal for a hungry owl.
And when the seed feeders come down in the spring, it's time to put up your hummingbird feeder. Gail wrote in asking for specifics on what to put in it.
Bridget says the Cornell Lab of Ornithology recommends 1/4 cup of sugar per cup of water, no food coloring. You'll need to change the liquid every 2 to 3 days. Another option, plant a garden for hummingbirds. Include plants like bee balm, cardinal flower, columbine, and jewelweed.
Sounds tasty. We welcome all your questions, comments, appreciation, and criticism. Get in touch on social media at Vermont Edition or email vermontedition@vpr.net.
Thanks, Rick.
You're welcome, Jane.
And that's it for today. Tomorrow, cleaning up Vermont's lakes, rivers, and streams. A water quality bill has just passed the House, and one is in committee in the Senate. We'll hear from Representative David Dean and State Senator Chris Bray on what they hope their bills will accomplish and on where they think funding will come from to pay for water cleanup. Send your questions or comments to vermontedition@vpr.net and listen tomorrow at noon. Vermont Edition is produced by Patty Daniels, Rick Singeri, and Sam Gale Rosen, with production assistance from Aaron Lucy. Mary Williams directed the show, and our executive producer is John Van Hoosen. I'm Jane Lindholm. Thanks for listening.